Hello and welcome to the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and this week we'll be talking about the risks going on that can affect your FinTech and an update on the state of blockchain. A lot of stuff going on. Please hit subscribe to keep up with this and the latest in FinTech news. All right, let's get started this week. Some big topics we're going to cover with Steve.
Hey, John. Good to be here.
Great. Great to have you here. And Sean.
Hey, John. Happy to be here.
Great. Yeah, glad you're here. All right. So if you follow the news at all, or if you haven't, coding day and night on your fintech, there have been a lot of changes going on, and I feel like we should talk about them. Put the finance a little bit in fintech. And we have the, first of all, the trade war, of course, has been going on.
What trade war? What do you mean?
Yeah, no, nothing going on there. And it's a world war, by the way. The currency war kind of going on as well. We have interest rates, which are crazy low in the United States and dropping, as well as all the money that's being collected from tariffs. $63 billion so far in the United States from that affecting the economy. And also just a more difficult environment in China. We talk about China a lot in terms of their use of mobile and their quick development of fintech products. Also their investing and joint ventures with the United States. That looks to be getting more difficult as well. So let's start with a quick breakdown of each one of these big areas that are kind of changing the landscape for how you're going to operate your fintech.
Sure. So can we first start? How do you think a lower interest rate environment will affect either fintech funding or just the fintechs that we're seeing pop up in the market nowadays?
So interest rates are very low right now, and it makes more sense to invest the money then keep it in savings accounts. You're not going to be making any good ROI on your savings accounts. As those interest rates get lower and lower, investors are getting happier and happier because they're able to make those investments and with better ease. And you look at specifically with fintech, disproportionately has been funded these past few years. You look at areas of payments is a good subsector. Neobanks are popping up. You have companies like Varo. You've got all these, brick and mortar banks coming up, and the space for investment in fintech, I think, it still has room to grow. And this lowering of interest rates only makes it makes it more apparent.
Yeah, but it's also an indication of greater risk and an expectation that the economy is not going to do as well, which is bad for fintechs. So a lot of these issues, a lot of these large changes, and currency is a great example, are kind of dual-edged swords. So a lot of these issues are kind of dual-edged swords. And the currency, the incipient currency war starting now, is a great example. President Trump has labeled China a currency manipulator. He's complained about the Chinese yuan declining and making Chinese products even more cheaper than they have been. And, adjusting those currencies, they make your products cheaper, but they're very hard to manage. With the U.S. as a kind of like the reserve currency of the world, it's not easy to do something like adjust your currency down. Usually your currency goes down when your economy is expected to do poorly. And right now the U.S. economy is doing relatively well compared to the rest of the world, certainly not declining as much as it has in Europe, and even with the official Chinese numbers down from where it was. There's always new opportunities to hedge other kinds of risks.
Also, just to piggyback off that, you know, consumer spending is at a two-year high. So people are spending more. There is more peer-to-peer transactions being taken place, right? With this, you know, relatively strong economy, there's more money. If a transaction is a neuron bumping between, you know, the society, you've got thousands and thousands of more neurons jumping between people. So you view this as like a, you're putting an atom in a microwave. You're seeing a lot more peer-to-peer transactions in the economy because consumer spending is at a 2-year high. So
Sean, are you saying my brain is like a slow economy?
It's slow to medium. But it's exciting, right? I mean, I think for fintechs, if you're a fintech CEO and if you're looking to be in this space, and as John mentioned, the trends that I'm seeing at least are that it's a very exciting time in the space because the consumer is benefiting a lot from these low interest rates. The consumer is benefiting a lot from what's been happening recently with the Fed, and they're spending a lot more. So it could be an opportunity for companies, especially in the P2P space, to innovate.
So I have a what is admittedly a very, very dumb question, right? We have a very
There are no dumb questions, Steve. Just dumb people.
Just dumb people. Well, I have a question from a dumb person here. So we have, of course, a very low interest rate environment in the U.S. But why then are all these fintechs coming up with high interest yield accounts, right? If you think of like Wealthfront and the Goldman Sachs product Marcus, and it seems like everyone has an APY, an annual percentage yield, is higher than say 2.5% or so. How does that work?
That's only high compared to the large banks, what the large banks are offering. So if Chase Bank is offering you 0.25%, it's very easy to say you're high yield compared to that. So it's not so much that that's a product of the interest rate marks in general. It's more like they're willing to share, and it's not clear to me in those cases if that fintech is losing money. You know, who's paying for that, right?
Which VC is covering that awesome APY?
Yeah, right. And it might be that they have the money to support that, and they have a lower cost structure where they can pay higher interest rates. But that's not directly tied to the interest rate markets we're seeing these days.
You mentioned Marcus by Goldman. It's interesting. They have such good rates, and makes you think, what's going on here?
Exactly. So what's the trick? What's the catch?
Yeah, I think they're just trying to get people in the door because Goldman hasn't been known as a Main Street bank. So my prediction is that they're trying to incentivize people to come in the door with those high initial rates. They're also getting really involved in something we talked about earlier in the consumer lending space. But to your question, I think it's interesting. A lot of the bigger banks are trying to incentivize people with these higher savings rates, and they may be fearing competition from fintechs, smaller fintechs coming in. So they're like, we don't want customer churn. Let's just bump up our savings, APY rates, right?
Yeah, I actually see that from my end. I have an online high yield Amex account, and that's my interest rate has gone up, or my APY rather, has gone up significantly over the past year and a half or so. And I can kind of track it as a reaction to any other splashy announcements about an APY. So it used to be like 2%, now it's up to like 2.8% or so. So, which is in line with what the Wealthfronts and the Marcuses offer in the marketplace. So it's kind of an interesting play to kind of follow them as they set the pace for what's a good interest rate.
So we're seeing that with interest rates dropping down, and they're expected to continue to dropping. The market is basically predicting that the rates will continue to fall, that the currency war and trade war will have negative effects on the economy. And it's very counterintuitive with what we're seeing in the United States. Sean mentioned the strong consumer spending, and we have very low unemployment, 50-year low unemployment in the United States. So it's very mixed message. It's like this cloudy sky, but with the big clouds that seeming to hover on the edges there.
Yeah, there were a good amount of skeptics when this rate cut happened. There were economists who had thought this would actually be a rate hike because now we're due for a stabilization. But the Trump administration decided, no, let's cut it again. So I was surprised that there was a cut. I know, John, you said that, you know, you weren't surprised. We'd love to hear your take on that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, mainly to do with these macro kind of concerns. It's a very mixed message. Like I was saying, you're seeing this great unemployment number, but it seems to be very U.S. focused. Outside and with our trade, it seems very uncertain. And the market hates uncertainty, right? You can see that with stock prices as well as and especially with the interest rate market. I mean, I think if Jay Powell or Jerome Powell sneezes, the Federal Reserve chair, there's some market reaction to that, because if he's sick, then that's going to have some implications on interest rate policy.
This could certainly be influenced by politics, right? I mean, Trump
politics
wants
is
that stable economy before
huge
the election,
in the trade war.
Right?
And you know what's scary about that, and predicting the environment is, and I saw this pointed out in the article I'll link to in our show notes, is this kind of new thing where trade policy or interest rate policy is kind of tied to other things rather than fundamental economics. So you saw Trump threaten tariffs against Mexico because of their immigration policy. And then you saw the administration threatening China with tariffs or blocking Huawei because of technology issues or being against their Belt and Road policy or internal subsidies of the firms within China. So it's kind of tying these issues, which makes the future that much more uncertain, right?
Not to mention the scary things the Chinese government's doing with its regulation. It's, to me, that is a cause for concern. They are, I mean, you look at what is happening in Hong Kong. I mean,
yeah,
they
right.
are...
Another big change. Yeah. I mean, there's so many right now. They have the unrest.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, they're doing things that they're taking stakes in these companies that have never been seen before. They're coming in creating a social credit system and linking it up with payments. And we were chatting about the power of Alipay. That they're doing something that I think Facebook now is trying to replicate, right, with Libra. They provided a model of what a scary government intervention a lot of the fintechs can be.
Yeah.
I'm worried about what the power Facebook has. I've been meaning to delete my account. The Libra adventure that they're on, I think, is very scary. I don't want Facebook to handle my payments.
No, I don't trust it one bit, not at all. Yeah.
It doesn't look like a clear success. I mean, there's so much resistance from individual consumers, from privacy advocates,
watchdogs, from policymakers. Everyone's weighing in on
everybody.
This and saying, please don't do this.
I've never seen an article or anybody come out with saying, yeah, just trust Facebook. That wasn't working at Facebook.
I've seen one positive article about Calibra and Libra, and it was a profile of the woman who's in charge of it, who's a 26-year-old woman who's the face of Libra at Facebook. And that's the only thing that I've seen that has had a positive light. Everything else has been a negative take on what they're doing.
Yeah,
makes sense.
I don't think you have to worry about them taking over the world. There's other cryptocurrencies out there, and
Yeah, I certainly can hedge my bets. I, not to harp on the Facebook point, but I am just astounded how much people trust Facebook with their data, and now they will be trusting them if all goes as planned with their payments and their credit card information. And it's a cause for concern. It's just too much power for what's supposed to be a social network.
Yeah. So given all the stuff that we've talked about, what are your predictions for the, you know, for Q1 or Q2 of next year for the fintech space? What will happen?
I would hope a continued growth, specifically within neobanks and payments platforms.
Yep.
So and if we look at the drivers of growth, right, let's look at investment. So investment, I would predict through Q3 of next year to be pretty strong within the fintech space.
Yep.
If we see a rate hike, that could change things. Things can get shaken up. What happens in Washington, D.C. can shake things up. But I would predict at least mid to three quarters of the way through next year, we're going to see some stabilized growth in terms of funding with fintechs, neobanks, payments platforms, as well as user growth base. So that, but who knows?
All right.
Yeah. Well, fintech has been getting, you know, just a huge increase in funding, and I think that will continue.
And users, actually, I follow somebody from the Revolut team on LinkedIn, and they mentioned that in one day they signed up 36,000 customers.
So what I was going to mention is that I think there's more the more that the world changes and the environment changes, there's going to create opportunities for more products. In ways that we haven't seen. And we've seen, as I mentioned before, that the large G-SIBs, the systemically important banks.
Too big to fail in English.
Too big to fail banks don't react very quickly to offer new products. And, you know, we see, I think JP Morgan was the one that had Finn. They shut down that
they
product.
Did, yeah.
Wells Fargo shut down their new mobile I think some initiative, and so they don't seem to be able to react quickly. And, you know, this is very innovator's dilemma kind of thing, right? So I think that's going to create more opportunities. The more volatile world we're in, the more volatile environment in currencies and interest rates and in asset markets, that this will just create more opportunity for fintechs.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you look at like the VIX index as a you know, a signal for volatility, I think there's going to be some really interesting things happening as we approach 2020 with volatility and how that as well as this narrative of decentralization. So take the power away from these big monolithic companies like the big players that own everything. Take those two factors and startups do well in that, and they do well in volatility because they're anti-fragile. As well as the fact that they do well with this decentralized narrative, because you're not going to give your more and more of your information to Facebook. Go to Revolut. Go to a company that hasn't breached your trust and is decentralized. You own that data more than you do at Facebook.
Yeah. So just one or two things to think about there as
small
as
tiny
you get in
things.
The world. Yeah, but definitely a world of opportunity for more flexible, smaller, nimble type of firms and business ideas. All right, let's go to blockchain and what's been going on in that world. We haven't done an update in that for a little while, right, Steve?
I think there's a reason why. Yeah.
So
I think about a year ago, we spent a lot of time on blockchain, and you know, it seemed like everyone was doing a lot of either proofs of technology, a lot of POCs and test and learns, and it seemed like didn't the Snapple company in New York like change their name to blockchain and their stock went up significantly? Like it was kind of a hot shit thing about a year and a half ago. In 2019,
are you saying
so
now
much.
It's just a shit thing?
Now it's just kind of a shit
it's
thing.
Cold.
Yeah, I think we're entering the trough of disillusionment, and eventually we'll get to the more usable, boring blockchain use cases. But there's a pretty interesting report from CB Insights that came out just this week that mentions sort of, you know, how are we in terms of funding and traction in the blockchain world, and they have three main things. The first one is VC investment. So we saw, you know, in 2018 and 17 were sort of the blockchain years, right? Everyone was getting into it, HODL or all these companies developing, you know, kitty coins and whatever. And essentially now, aside from Facebook, it seems like that's no longer the case. And they actually have some metrics behind this. So according to their predictions, 2019 will only see about $1.6 billion in investments, which is, you know, a little less than half of what we saw in 2018. So in 2018, we saw $4.1 billion. 2019, $1.6 billion.
In blockchain-related fintech funding.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So the amount of money going into blockchain has decreased significantly. They also mentioned that there's been a lot of, as I mentioned before, a steep decline in corporations either announcing or just doing anything with the DLT or blockchain.
So I like where they track how many times a certain topic is mentioned in earnings calls.
Yes.
And I'm sure the peak of blockchain is long in the past.
I think we're sort of at the peak of the AI mention now. It's all about the AI, right? So, you know, it used to be big data 5 years ago, then blockchain, and now AI. I don't know what the next one will be, but yeah. So it seems to have taken a backseat to that stuff. The other interesting thing is that they mentioned also, we talked a lot in the show about ICOs, right? How shady they are. Don't invest in an ICO, by the way. And they have basically said that ICOs are essentially dead. You know, we went through hundreds of ICOs last year. very few this year, and it also we saw potentially the potential of maybe companies going through an ICO route to raise funds and bypassing the whole VC space. But that's kind of swung back now, and we see a lot of more companies in the blockchain space. If they do raise money, which are a few of them, they're all going through VCs, not ICOs.
Do you think that's because consumers who put in money for ICOs have kind of, they feel burned?
I believe that's the case. We in maybe about a month and a half ago, so we had a stat where something like 97% of ICOs were scams. There were basically no legit ICOs in the U.S.
They put up a white paper?
Even with a white paper, yeah.
You know, copy, paste, find, and replace.
Yes. Yeah. The article actually, depending on whether you're a blockchain enthusiast or not, it actually ends on somewhat of a high note, right? And the high note is that despite all the setbacks that we've noticed in terms of the funding and sort of the lack of traction from both consumers and corporations, we have the big behemoth, which is, of course, Libra. So Libra has kind of brought blockchain back on the forefront. And the other thing is that also, this came out in the news a few weeks ago, but apparently Twitter has several openings, for blockchain developers to work at Twitter.
It seems like there's still some work. I think I saw IBM is still working on their logistics kind of blockchain and bringing in a lot of partners to do that. Like you were saying, it's kind of like that back-end development going on still during the trough of disillusionment, and it becomes the boring back-end of your transaction that you never see, but it's there, and it's not making anyone multimillionaires overnight, maybe, but it's just serving its person. It's like Unix. It's like maybe you bet into, or Linux, I should say, where you bet into some hot companies early on, they all died, but then now it's the back end of everything.
Yeah.
And it's definitely not sexy as it was.
And now
most people anyway.
Among most people, yeah. I even saw recently that I think it was the IRS that's going after people who had significant gains in blockchain, so they're actually being served tax bills. Because they can see, of course, because it's a ledger, you can see how much they've actually made in their transactions. So there's even now...
Well, I think these letters were related to the Coinbase disclosure, where maybe a year and a half ago they asked Coinbase to give them anyone that had transaction of over $20,000.
Mm-hmm.
And it was close to that number of the letters that they sent. So they didn't say specifically, but people are speculating, well, that sounds suspiciously like what the information you got from Coinbase was.
So do you think it's stabilized then in terms of, if we look at investment, right, that's a big cut.
It's a huge cut. It's a 60% cut.
In a hugely rising fintech funding environment.
Yeah.
Correct, yeah. So you see a lot of funding for consumer-facing fintech startups, and not as much in blockchain.
In payments, for sure.
And payments is a big one as well. Klarna just got a... Mm-hmm. Klarna is not the most valued startup in Europe, right? The Snoop Dogg startup.
Wow, Snoop Dogg, yeah.
Yeah. I wonder how much he invested, by the way, because he's met some... He bet on Robinhood.
I think he just got... He probably got some exchange for shares for promoting the...
I think he did, but he also did the same thing for Reddit and for Robinhood. So he's an investor in all those companies.
Entrepreneur,
yeah. Him and Ashton Kutcher, right? But yeah, I think that, you know, this is ultimately good for blockchain, I think. I think that it'll take away a lot of the foamy sentiment. It'll take away a lot of the hype and the buzz and sort of the outright scams in the space. So hopefully in 3 years we'll see an actual working blockchain doing things like boring crap like trade finance.
We're still waiting for that working blockchain.
We're still waiting
we?
For that one. Yeah.
Is there anything that's in production yet?
With regard to
like a blockchain product?
The supply chain use case is a very powerful one.
Right? It's a use case. But is there something out in
it
the wild
been operational
already?
I'm not sure.
But the
use case is powerful. Also, you know, if we're talking about obviously with payments, you know, certainly that could be something of importance. Also, storing personal information. If you just want to store the key on the blockchain and create a sort of secure passing of information between nodes, you don't want to store PII on the blockchain, but if you store a key, so there's certainly still some elements out here. But what you're saying is that the noise is out, and it's also or it's more signal now. It's more actual content.
My hypothesis here is that the noise is out, and I think that this is good for the technology because it means that a lot of the actual players will maybe embrace it and operationalize it and actually put it into use. which we hadn't seen.
Your promise, Steve?
I think within 3 years. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, you know, three years ago. That's what I was going to say. I was so excited about the Ethereum blockchain and the Ethereum Foundation.
And Ripple and all this stuff, yeah.
The Ethereum Foundation especially, you know, there's so many projects on there.
Yeah.
And Gollum and the shared distributed network on Ethereum. And there's so many. By now, it would have taken over the world. But
yeah. Mwah, mwah.
Name one. Email me. Email info@fintechnewscast.com if you know of a blockchain thing that's in production.
In the wild.
That's working for... yeah, right. It's open to consumers, not closed in testing in your real product.
Right. To be determined.
All right. Let's get started on our final bites, where we take a look at a number. And the way Steve tells it, it becomes fascinating.
So my number is... Actually, no, I shouldn't do this because I just talked about this. I just burnt my fucking final bite. So
edit
you
it
should
out.
Go first.
You can
edit it out.
Do it here and edit it out there.
Edit it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Great, yeah. So my final bite is $5.5 billion. A lot of money, right?
All right. Your earnings last year?
The money that I found in my couch last
year. Oh, man. All right. Steve Bezos.
What currency are we talking? Dollar strong.
No, it's $5.5 billion, which is the valuation of Klarna. They raise $400 million to become the most valued startup in Europe, beating, I believe, N26, which is the German-based neobank.
Yeah, well, you had me at Snoop Dogg.
Yeah.
I'm in. All right, my final bite is 3963. And this is House Bill 3963, which is the Virtual Value Tax Fix Act. Very well named, actually, right? The Tax Fix Act. Well, virtual value in this case is talking about cryptocurrencies. Those first green shoots of legislation on how cryptocurrencies should be taxed and, more broadly, how they should be regulated. This particular bill was introduced by Representative Ted Budd, a Republican out of North Carolina, calls cryptocurrencies a national security issue.
Interesting.
That's always, I guess he wants to get some attention. But, you know, it clarifies things on, like, how it should be taxed, what happens when the cryptocurrency is forked, whether you need to pay tax on that, what the tax situation should be when you're exchanging one cryptocurrency for another, and the heart seems to be in the right place, like encouraging cryptocurrencies by not taxing some of these events, so allowing people to make more use of these things without having to pay a tax at every step along the way. And this is just one of the bills that are out there. There's another one introduced by Todd Emmer called the Safe Harbor for Taxpayers with Forked Assets Act of 2019.
Jesus, not spooned.
Yes, right. And that's another piece of legislation that aims to clarify the tax situation.
We'll see how that goes. All right, Sean, what's your number?
My number is 826. It's not the amount of times you've checked your Instagram feed today, but it is the number of fintech startups this year that has been shut down in Indonesia.
Indonesia.
Who would have thought?
Yeah.
Indonesia.
They're anti-fintech?
They seem to be anti-companies that abuse ethical practices. I don't know if they're anti-fintech. So these companies that they labeled as illegal startups had been practicing unethical methods of collection and unethical rates for their products. And there were some shady activities these Indonesian startups were apparently practicing. The interesting thing here is that about 90% of the Indonesian population does not carry credit cards, does not have a lot of these advanced products that we use here in the U.S.
You mean they can't get into debt over their head on consumer?
20% interest rates.
They can use Klarna to buy shoes online?
that they don't need? Yeah.
So what happened was these companies had seen this opportunity for massive growth, and apparently what they'd started to do was to practice some really shady ways of abusing their customers, and the Indonesian government has shut down these numbers of startups. But for all you Indonesian fintech entrepreneurs out there, practice ethically, and there could be a big opportunity. It's an underserved market, and it's going to be exciting to see what happens there soon.
All right, yeah, that's an interesting area, Sean. Thanks. Well, that's it for this episode of the FinTech Newscast. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in fintech news. And thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
Bye for now.
Thanks.